right, we're going to continue on our Advent conspiracy. We have been talking for the last few weeks. We have been conspiring to change the world. And oh, Kidmo, yes, Kidmo can go. If you are in Kidmo, you are welcome to head on out. I'm not sure who our Kidmo leader is today. I think it might be Pam. She's upstairs, so just go upstairs and don't fall down the stairs, whatever you do. But we do have insurance in case they do. I'm just kidding. Hopefully that won't happen. So we've been doing something a little different. We've been walking through the book of Mark for several weeks, and we've taken a break to focus more on the story of Jesus' birth, primarily through Matthew, because Mark does not include that in his gospel. I want to remind you where we've been, and I want you to understand where we're going today, because I don't have a lot to share with you, but what I have to share with you I think is incredibly important. So the first week we talked about some of the religious astronomical anomalies happening, creating a context for the birth of Jesus in week one. And we've talked about the shifting of the planet and how religions focused heavily on just astrological signs. Where are the stars? What's moving? Which prominent stars are moving and not? When you don't have a TV or you don't have things to do at night other than to burn candles and talk or work around the house, you go to bed or you go outside and you look at the stars. And so stars became incredibly important. And without some of the advances that we have to know how the universe works and how the galaxies work and how the universe moves, but yet the stars in our galaxy don't move. They began to create whole religions around these stars. And what we discovered the first week is that there was a massive shift happening just in the religious culture with new religions popping up because the sun no longer rose on the summer equinox the way that it used to do, or the spring equinox the way it used to. And as they traced it back, that spawned a new religion, which gives new meaning to this idea that there was a star to illuminate the birth of Jesus. So for them, this was incredibly important. This event, they had to find out who it was, and we're going to talk more about that event today, but they had to find out who it was and where it was happening, and it created all kinds of chaos in politics. It created all kinds of chaos in religion. And for us, we often approach these stories with a lack of context, to a place where we just say, you know what, this is interesting, baby's born, great, he's in a manger, he turned out okay. I mean, that's fine. But we miss this massive story that's happening around that God is telling where he is literally moving heaven and earth for us, and that's part of what we celebrate at Christmas. Last week, John did a good job talking about this, the reality that God chose to enter into this world, into humanity in circumstances that were incredibly shameful for the religious culture of the day. And we cannot miss that. That God chose for Jesus to be born of a virgin, but no one believed that's what was happening here. And instead, there was a reputation or a stigma that would be attached to Joseph and Mary, in which Joseph was like, I don't know that I want to go through with this. And had it not been a vision, he might not have gone through with it. But instead, he did, and he said, I'm going to be with you. And they go for a census. It's time for Jesus to be born. And in the insula, or in the family compound, where normally if you had a family member who's about to bust, and they're supposed to be there out of town traveling for whatever, you're going to make room in the most comfortable room in the house, right? But not them. There is no room at the most comfortable room in the house. And instead, they end up going downstairs where you would bring the animals inside, and that is where Jesus is born. The stigma and the reputation followed them, and they continue to have to carry this. And the question I left you with last week was simply, what does it say about a God who would choose that this is the circumstance in which I'm going to enter into the world? I'm going to enter into the world in a way that all of the religious people are going to snub their nose, and all of the people that are being observant followers are going to say, you know what? You made this decision. We don't want to have anything to do with you. And it just demonstrates that when God is coming into the world, he's coming for people that we don't always think about. And John gave a great illustration of the bottle of water. Do we have room in our lives to accept people that are different from us, who live different from us, who have different ways of different belief systems than us. Can we love them the way that Jesus loved them? He entered into this really incredible time. But there's this other event that's happening. And, you know, we try to stay away from politics here. We're going to talk about politics today. So I know you're super excited that you got out of bed and that you came. But we're not going to talk about U.S. politics, all right? We're going to talk about Roman politics because Jesus coming, this conspiracy of the birth of Jesus, I mean, this was just massive at the time. This was world-changing. It is still world-changing. And when we understand how this story is being told, it just, we begin to learn what it looks like to live life, what it looks like to have joy. We light the Advent candles of hope and peace and joy and love. What does it look like to live in that way? I want to share with you some statistics about what some of our philosophical and psychological researchers say about having happiness, what it takes to have it, and why we often miss it. But ultimately, I want you to see that at this Christmas season, as we're giving for those in need, a good part of our life is not about what we are getting. A good part of our life is about what we are giving. And the process of getting really derails a whole lot of us. Richard Rohr is a monk who wrote a little book, and he talks about the two halves of life. And he says, not everybody reaches the second half of life. The first half of life is marked by competition, the need to get it, the need to get yours, the need to excel in career, to make sure you have a nice enough car and a nice enough house, and for other people to look up to you and think well of you. And that is marked by competition and the need for more. But there's something beautiful about the second half of life. And the second half of life, and not everybody makes the second half of life. It's not delineated by age or necessarily experience. It's a way of discovering who you are and who you want to be that changes you. And in the second half of life, rather than the need for more or to get or to be recognized as better than others, no competition. Instead, it is purpose and loving others and relationships and being at peace and being settled and being content. We live in a nation that our mantra is the pursuit of happiness, but often what happens is we miss the happiness that we actually do have along the way in its pursuit. And the person I want to talk to you about today is a man who had everything, and yet it was never enough. As we go back and we look at some of the Old Testament stories, a lot of the impact of the story of Exodus on Deidre and I, as we've made changes in our lives over the last few years, was the idea of the nation of Israel walking through the desert and grumbling because they don't have enough. They need more food. They need more to sustain them. And then the incredible story of God providing manna, but in such a way that there was only enough for that day. And because he commanded them to take a Sabbath, he said, on the day leading up to the Sabbath, you will collect a double portion, so you don't have to work on the Sabbath. But I will only give you enough for that day. And if you pick extra, if you gather extra, it will be bad the next day, except on the Sabbath. Do you have enough? Deidre and I began asking some hard questions just about what does enough look like for us. And I recognize that most of us, we've grown up in a marketing-rich culture in which marketers like myself, that's my day job is to be a marketer, convince people your life is not enough without whatever the thing is that they want to sell you. Incredibly, even in this industry of marketing, there's a move towards ethical, responsible marketing in which people recognize we've learned the psychology of people that we can get them to not feel like their life is good enough until they have our thing. But that is not always good. And so there's a small but growing number of ethical marketers saying, you know what, we need to be careful what we use these tools for. And as Christians, we need to recognize that we have an opportunity to partner with God in helping people live out this story, which is another reason why we don't do a whole lot of marketing for our church. Because once you try to start using psychology and marketing to get people to want to know something about Jesus is no longer enough. And so it's a very tentative relationship between this, do I have enough or do I need more? The person I want to tell you about today was a ruler of Israel, and he was a man that did not want the power. Leading up to the birth of Jesus, those in control were of the house of the Hasmoneans. It was called the Hasmonean dynasty. And they led Israel, and in this time, there was an incredible amount of just unrest with Rome. I want to remind you that Rome is a central character in this story. The word gospel that we use to talk about that Jesus came and he gave his life for us, and that if we believe in him and confess with our mouth that Jesus is Lord and God raised him from the dead, we would be saved. That was not the meaning of the gospel at the time in which the apostles started using it. When they were using it, it was solely a word that Rome used to dictate all of the wonderful things Rome was doing. This is when Hellenism is growing, and rather than being a people of community, we begin to see humanity shifting under this powerful philosophy of Hellenism that said, you know what life is about? Life is about you. Where leading up to this time, life was about us. And today, even though we don't talk about Hellenism as a driving force of the way we live life, we are absolutely products of that thought. It's about me getting what I want. And if I need something from you to get it, then that is perfectly okay. That is the pursuit of happiness. A lot of times when we try to figure out how has somebody made it in the world, how many times do we look at a person and say, you know what, they are so incredibly generous. I mean, those people, like, people do terrible things to them, and they never get upset. They get taken advantage of, and people just use them, and yet they are at such peace all the time. How many times do we look at somebody and we say, that is the most just appreciative person we've ever seen? Like, they are saying thank you to everybody, even when I don't think they've done all that much. I mean, they're the kind of person that shows up, and rather than bringing in lots of things and lots of gifts and lots of toys and lots of things, instead they come in and they just encourage everyone they're around. When was the last time we looked at a person and said, that person has made it because they encourage everybody they're with? We don't. The reality is when we talk about somebody making it, what are the indicators that we look at that they've made it? Well, we look at their house and their car and their wealth and their how far up the work ladder are you? And what we find are that those things actually rob you of life many times, not always. I'm just going to encourage you that if you don't have enough money to buy food, money is incredibly important, amen? But if you don't have enough money to add the third screen into your car because you want the full technology package, like, life goes on without a third screen, you know? So as we look at this character, this is a guy who did not want power, but he had wealth. In fact, he said, we need to elect a prince from the Hasmonean dynasty to take over leadership of Israel, but Rome is falling apart. We have leading up to this the story of Julius Caesar, which you can go read. We talked a little bit about that the first week. And in this story, there is incredible civil war because it is a republic similar to the United States as a republic. So I said we wouldn't talk about U.S. politics. Maybe this will be the extent of it. But we are a republic. If you go back and you talk about us being a democracy, the United States was set up as a republic very similar to the way that Rome functioned. They had a Senate just like that we have a Senate. They had control and different ways to control power or to hold power accountable. And yet this incredibly powerful military personality, Julius Caesar, begins to take over. And he begins to grow the Roman Republic. It's not the Roman Empire. It's the Roman Republic. And he eventually begins seizing power. And when he seizes power, he develops a whole lot of enemies that do not want to see him in power, which is why we know the story of Julius Caesar, Et tu, Brute? You remember studying that in English in high school, right? So Julius Caesar, He was literally a figurehead who had no power. And as we discussed on week one of Advent Conspiracy, his lineage, those who would take over after him, were nowhere to be found. He didn't have any children that could take the reign. But he had adopted his grandnephew and adopted him as his son. His name was Augustus, or Octavius was his original name. And yet there was another major character, if you remember your story of Julius Caesar, named Mark Antony, who was a very powerful general, who when Julius Caesar was killed, wanted to take over power. What ended up happening, and the reason the star was important, and I don't want to completely rehash, I just find it a fascinating story. I don't want to completely rehash that story. There was a comet that shot across the sky, and Augustus thought, this is my chance to take power. Now, if you don't know the power of imagination, think about this. A man took over an entire empire simply by watching a comet and being able to tell a good story. And the story he told was, that comet is our leader, our Caesar Julius, ascending to the heavens, because Julius is a deity and all of his lineage is a deity. Do we have any other of his lineage that might also be of that branch of deities? Oh, me. It's me. And so eventually Augustus takes over, and then Augustus begins a campaign of becoming the first true emperor of Rome. And it is in this environment in which Jesus is born. Why do I bring this up? Because Rome is trying to control a whole empire, of which Israel is just a small vassal state. And they need a leader. And this leader begins to align himself with Caesar when Caesar's around. And when Caesar's gone, he aligns himself with Mark Antony. And then when Mark Antony doesn't take the reins, he then aligns himself with Octavius, who would then become Augustus, who would become the first true emperor of Rome, and who was the emperor of Rome during the life of Jesus. And yet this ruler of Israel didn't want this power, but he was incredibly wealthy. His family controlled a good part of the real estate in the area. They controlled the spice trade, which meant lots of money came in. He began to develop relationships with Rome, and Rome wanted his money and wanted his influence. And even though he said, don't give me the kingship, keep it in the Hasmonean dynasty, they said, no, we want you. And so he took it. And when he took that power, it changed him. This is where we enter into our story in Matthew chapter 2. You're going to be familiar with it. I'm not going to read this whole story, but I want to just introduce it with the first part of chapter 2, and then I want to ask just the question, what does this mean for us? Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them the time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word, that I too may come and worship him. And after listening to the king, they went on their way. And behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. Now, to give you an idea how incredibly powerful and influential and important King Herod was at this time, we see that not only is he a man of immense wealth, he is also a man of immense ingenuity. And some of the most incredible building projects that happened at this time of his reign are still there, remnants of it are still there today, things that had never been done before, things that have never been done again. I put a few pictures together. I think my slides are a little out of order, but I put a few pictures together. One of the things he is most known for is not building the second temple, but renovating it. If you'll remember, when the disciples were walking with Jesus through the temple courtyards, they said, "How beautiful are these stones?" They said that Herod had completely reconditioned the whole Temple Mount, and it just shone and glowed. The stone was polished in such a way that when the sun would shine on it, it would just glow. So that if you were a dignitary coming into Israel, you would go up and see the temple, and you would just be amazed. And Jesus says, "In 3 days I will destroy and rebuild this temple." That was the scenario in which he said that. But he expanded and just made a glorious creation. This is a model. It's not what it looks like today. This glorious second temple. The second thing that I wanted to show you was Masada, which was this incredible fortress built on top of this mountain. Can you imagine just getting up there, much less building a fortress? There's an incredible story about Masada that you can read later, in which the Jews are trying to revolt against Rome, and Rome comes to take them out, and they hole up into this fortress, and eventually they all kill themselves rather than being taken over by Rome. So not a really feel-good story. I wouldn't read that on Christmas morning. All right. He also built a mountain in which he took a hill and he had them truck in dirt loads, or not truck in, but I don't know how he did it. But he brought in loads and loads of dirt and rock, and they created this big mountain that would be Herod's mountain in an area that didn't have big mountains like this. I think the next slide shows the top view. And he built a fortress up there. This is the Herodian, where he would go and he could visit if he wanted to escape any of his enemies. The third or fourth thing I want to show you is called the Caesarea Maritima, which is the port of Caesarea, in which this is the first time that they build a port out into the water. And he uses Roman ingenuity. He trucks in Roman concrete. He mixes it with volcanic ash. And he's able to create a port in order for them to continue to sell their wares and their trade. And they can continue to grow just the national domestic product of Israel so that they could continue to grow as a nation. It's where he could send out his own product, being in charge of the spice trade, owning all of that passage. I think, is that my last picture? Did I include another one? Oh, and this is just a depiction of King Herod. Now, we know of King Herod as an evil, evil man, right? But in the midst of civil war, King Herod united Israel. In a time of unrest, when people weren't sure who was in control and who was in power, he provided leadership with Rome that just stabilized the nation. It was said that he was a devout Jew, that he would follow the Torah. And yet when he was coronated to become king in Rome, he would also sacrifice to the god Jupiter, the Roman god. So he was a complex guy. If we continue in this story in Matthew chapter 2, what we're going to find is that what the story tells us is that he's going to order the death of the firstborn of every house in Israel for fear that this was going to be the king of the Jews. And in his mind, in all likelihood, he's thinking back to Caesar's comet. This is how Augustus took over. Is now someone else in Israel going to try to take over my reign? He was wealthy. He had power. He was ingenious. He could do whatever he wants. He's gone down as one of the greatest builders in antiquity. And yet he was scared of a baby that was being born and didn't even have room in the main house with everyone else, and his first bed was a manger. This power and this wealth, it changed him. Even though he wanted one of the Hasmonean princes to become the king instead of himself, once Rome gave him power, amazingly, shortly thereafter, that prince was found dead, floating in the water. It said about him that he was incredibly paranoid. It is said about King Herod that he would eventually go and kill several of his family members, including his own children, because he felt like they would betray him. And it's also said that after going through a prolonged illness in which he just fought for his life and his body just decayed within him, they said you could smell the decay coming out of him. That he gave an order before he died that said, I want you to kill the ruler, I don't know who all they were, but I want you to kill the other leaders of Israel so that upon my death, there will be mourning across the nation of Israel like there never was, save the fact that no one was actually mourning for him. He was a messed up guy. But by all accounts, Herod had made it like no one else had ever made it before. It's in this environment that Jesus is born of a virgin who is shamed and pushed out to say, I have come for all people. This story is so much bigger than the little, I call them manger scenes. They're supposed to be called nativities. I call them manger scenes. I don't know, does anybody else call them manger scenes? Make me feel better? No? Just me. Thank you. One person. Everybody else, you use the correct language, right? Nativity? I don't. But we go by our tree or by our coffee tables or by wherever we've set up our little nativities, and we go, oh, this is such a beautiful story. And yet it's a story of political intrigue, assassination, great paranoia and fear, a whole political shift in the entire world that is happening by this little baby born in a manger. This is the story of Jesus. The reason I'm telling you this story is because there are times in life where more is more. When Deidre and I got married, she was a full-time school teacher. I was in school. We had almost no money, and we struggled to stretch every dollar. Does anybody else know how that feels? I mean, we lived in a little bitty 600-square-foot apartment, and it was like, I don't know, are we going to eat? Or are we going to put gas in the car? You know, it's every time. I'm 52 years old. I mean, 42 years old. But every time I fill up my car, I never put $5 in my car unless it's a rental car. I always fill my gas tank up when I stop and get gas because I don't want to stop and keep getting gas. But every single time I fill up my gas tank, I remember what it was like to only be able to put $5 in and hope it lasts me till I got another $5. There's a time in life where more is more, right? There's a time when you have to be able to pay your bills. You want to keep the lights on. You want to keep the heat on. You want to keep the water on. I mean, you've got to make your car payment. If you've gotten into debt, you've got to make your debt payments. You've got to pay your rent. You've got to pay your house payment. You've got to fix your car at the time when you just got everything else covered and then your car breaks down. You're like, now how am I going to do that? Which is often how we do get into debt. I'll just pull the credit card out. Sometimes more is more. But sometimes more leads you to become a paranoid, crazy person. And what I have found as I've lived my life and as I've grown and as we've, like Paul said, I've learned to live with little, I've learned to live with much. See, more and more, this desire for more kills life. Now, we've got a bunch of college students in here. We've got a friend of Emma's is here with us today, Whitney. Y'all should go meet Whitney. She just graduated yesterday. She's launching into her career. We all remember what it's like to do that. Yes. Look at her. She's turning red. She's like, don't mention my name. She's the sweetest person you'll ever meet. We all know what it's like to start off. And the goal when we enter into college and the goal when we enter into our first careers is I've got to make it. I got to get there. I got to make sure I got the right job. And as a dad, I'm like, you know, I was having a conversation with Malia. She loves animals. I said, well, what do you think about being a veterinarian? She's like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to see them when they're sick. I just want to be a dog walker. And I was like, well, let's look at the earning potential of a dog walker. But then And then my family members informed me how much a dog walker can make, and I'm actually thinking about becoming a dog walker. This might be my last Sunday here with you. As a dad, I want them to earn enough that they can fill up their gas tank and not just put $5 in. That's what I want for my kids. But in all likelihood, they're going to be at a point where they're going to have to only put $5 in at a time. But there are things about life that more is not always more. More is not always better. More is not always going to lead you to happiness. There were a couple of studies that were done back in 2010 and in 2022 that tried to correlate earning with happiness. And there was originally a study done. I think I have a, do I have a chart? Jeremy, do I have a chart back there? All right. The first chart is a study done in 2010. The second chart is a study done in 2022. The first chart tracks, I know this is really faint, you can't see it, income and then fraction of population experiencing happiness. And the way they did that was they did a survey, or they took a Gallup poll in which people would indicate, based on how much income they have, how often they smile, how often they are happy, how often they are experiencing joy, versus how often are they experiencing sadness. And so you can't really see the numbers here, but they start at $10,000 and they go up to $120,000. Now, this is in 2010. And this first study determined that when you reach about $75,000 a year, your household income, it begins to level off, where even when you begin earning more than that, the happiness benefit is just not, it doesn't increase at the same level. 2022, another study was done that said, $75,000, are you crazy? There's no way. And this chart starts at $15,000 and goes up to roughly $500,000 a year. And you can see that correlation on those same measurements, in which they have increased from $75,000 to $500,000 a year earning before you experience kind of the top level of happiness. For some of us, you think, if I could just make $1 million a year, I would be happy. And yet, wealthy person after wealthy person after wealthy person says that's not true. I should have pulled up a quote by Jim Carrey who said, I wish everyone could just get all their dreams met and become wealthy and famous to find out that none of those things give them what they're looking for. This is the next slide. This is the quote in which they said, some of the summary of their study. Most people fall into one of two groups, the research found. Most people's happiness rises linearly with income, while about 30% of people are happiest, experiencing accelerating well-being once their earnings rise above $100,000. Now, some of you are in here going, $100,000? I couldn't make it on that. And others in here going, $100,000? Oh my gosh, I'd be the happiest person in the world if we made $100,000 a year. I do want to just remind us that times change. And next slide, between those two studies, median home price today is around $406,000. Like the kind of the middle, not average, but the median price, $406,000. In 2010, it was $173,000 for the same house. In 2024, the median car price is $48,000 if you're going to go buy a new car. But in 2010, it was $29,000. Median household income in 2024 is now $81,000, but in 2010, it was $49,000. So it makes sense that we're going to see some level of increase, that you need to make more in order to be happy. But the main point and the reason I bring all of this up is this. You need to have enough money to pay your basic bills. But after that, money is not going to give you happiness. And in the state of, in the story of King Herod, money did not equate happiness for him. He became scared, paranoid. I just have this picture, if we were going to have the birth of Jesus today, of Mary and Joseph like in an alleyway, and she's given birth in an alleyway next to a dumpster, And you know, and then this motorcade comes flying by, you know, with all these police cars and limos and these bulletproof SUVs just come flying by, and that's Herod. And he spends the rest of his life scared of that baby being born in next to a dumpster. And God is so amazing because he uses the lowly things of the world to demonstrate how beautiful life can be. And yet we tend to chase everything else when we don't feel like we have enough. You can have everything and be miserable at the same time. So sometimes more is more, and I don't want to ignore that. Sometimes less is more. And that is the story that we get from Jesus over and over again. In Galatians, it says, if you're experiencing the life that Jesus wants you to experience, then you will experience the fruit of the Spirit, which is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things, there is no law. What happens when you begin to have more and more and more is you also begin to have more and more and more worries, more and more fears. My dad, when he bought a car, he would say, now the purpose of a car is not for it to be driven, which utterly confused me. And he would tell me when Deidre was at Carson Newman going to school and I was at UT in Knoxville going to school, it was about an hour drive. He didn't tell me I couldn't drive up there, but he let me know that the car's not supposed to be driven that much. We never got any of the bells and whistles. Do you know why? Because that's just more things to what? Break. Yeah, you all heard it too. That's a time when we begin to realize that sometimes less is more, because now my car won't run because the electronics, something happened. Or now I can't even turn on the car because the radio doesn't work, because somehow the radio and the engine are now tied in together. Why in the world is the radio and the engine tied in together? Sometimes less is more. Sometimes when we have less stuff, we end up having more friends. Sometimes when we have less fears of losing stuff or somebody taking our stuff. I mean, how many storage places do we have in this city? How many are being built right now? Because we can't even fit it into our house. So, many of you know, I've been spending the last couple of weeks up in Knoxville helping my mom. She's continuing to deal with her cancer, and so we watch two things at my mom's house. We watch 20-year-old Hallmark movies, which are Christmas movies right now, which are incredibly unrealistic, by the way. If you're a Hallmark Christmas movie watcher, like, there's no reality built into those movies. It is so, I watch it, and I'm like, are you kidding me? I mean, that's not how the world works, right? Right? You agreeing with me, Dylan? Every movie is the same movie, isn't it? Oh, my goodness. That's the truth. I mean, you can see it coming. You can see it, and you can even see, they're even the same props. It's like, we've got to save the Christmas village. Oh, we did, and we fell in love. Oh, wow, the exact same Christmas village in a different state. And then they fell in love. It's an amazing thing. So we watch those movies. If you want to know any of them, I've watched them all at least twice now. The second thing we watch is HGTV. And you know what HGTV, the only reason that channel exists is to keep people who renovate homes in business, right? Because you're completely happy with your home until they put that gigantic island in the kitchen and you're like, my home is the worst. I mean, this is no better than being homeless at this point. And I watched one this week with her and it was really, you know, the craftsmanship is unbelievable. But I watched one, and it was a family of four who had like a 6,000 square foot home. And at the time, this was like 8 years ago, the home was worth $600,000. So it's probably worth like twice that today. And they're like, we have two kids now. We just don't have enough space. This house just no longer works for us. And I'm like, are you kidding me? This house. So they're going to go buy a $1 million house because the 6,000 square foot house doesn't work. We don't have enough bonus rooms. We don't have enough mud rooms. The kitchen's not big enough because we need to be able to feed 5,000 people in our kitchen. And then it will be enough. I just think, gosh, less Less is more. Bigger house is more cleaning. A bigger house, more maintenance. A bigger house is a bigger air conditioner. When the air conditioner goes out, that's more expensive. Some of you are thinking, Mark, you don't get it. I know I don't. I don't want to get it anymore. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Less is more. Jesus says in Matthew 16:24, he says, Jesus said, told his disciples, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. You have to take up your cross and follow him and give up this idea of life to find what true life is. And Herod never had it. And Jesus was trying to show everyone he came in contact with what that kind of life looks like. I need to wrap up. I got a couple of things I want to say to you. John 14:6 says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on, you know him and have seen him. He is the way. So what would cause a ruthless, wealthy, successful king to be envious of a baby that was born into shame, didn't have a room in the family home to be born, and was laid in a manger instead of a bed? Is it possible that the things we are trying to attain are leading us away from true happiness? Our busyness, our need for stuff, our need to travel, our need for a better whatever, is actually leading us away from the happiness that we have. There's a Roman poet by the name of Juvenal. He coined the phrase panem et circenses in Latin, which means bread and circuses. He used it to describe how Augustus would take over Rome and move it from a republic to an empire. Bread and circuses. This is what he said. He said, give them bread and circuses, and they will never revolt. Let me read that again. Don't miss this. Give them bread and circuses, and they will never revolt. People in power and people with wealth have placated humanity for years by keeping us distracted on the things that don't matter, thinking that's what real life is. And yet as we grow older, we recognize the stuff doesn't matter, the people do. As kids move away, we stop thinking about all the things that we need to do right and make and bake and parties to go to when we just want the kids to come in, right, kids? Just letting all you kids know that. We just want you there. When you do sit at home as you watch someone you care about just diminish until they die, you think, all I really want is more time and relationships. And you look at a family that has everything, and wealth is not evil. The Bible never says wealth is evil, but what wealth can do to you is evil. And so a family can have everything and be miserable. And a family with nothing can be full and happy. Now keep in mind, a family with nothing can also be miserable, and a family with everything can be full and happy. It just is a lot harder when that's the focus of our hearts. I've got a video, it's a really short video, but I want you to see it. It just came across my feed a while ago, and I mentioned it to our Practicing the Way group last week, and I just wanted to share it with you. A short little video on priorities. Some of you may have already seen this. This does have sound, by the way.
Good afternoon, everyone. We all have this one life to live. Fleeting shadow amongst all of existence, that's the universe. We have the ability to accomplish anything, truly anything, if we use our time wisely. Is this joyful? Is it full now? Yes. And how about now? Is the jar full now?
Yes.
Now, I want you to recognize that this jar represents your life. Golf balls are the important things, your family, your friends, your health, and your passions. The pebbles are the other important things, your car, your job, your home. The sand is everything else, it's just a small sand. Now, if you put the sand in your jar first, you won't have room for the pebbles or the golf balls. The same is true of life. You spend all your energy and time on the small stuff. You won't have time for all the really important things that matter to you. Pay attention to the things that are critical to your happiness. Take care of the golf balls first, the really important things. Set your priorities, because everything else is.
Yes. Professor, what is the
mirror? I'm glad you asked. It goes to show that no matter how full your life may seem to be, there's always room for a couple of years.
That's it. There we go. It's a great video, and the question I would ask you is, where in your life is more? And where in your life is less more? Where have we made room for the things that are really important? And where in our lives are we focused on filling up the sand, the little things, the how we spend our time, where we waste it watching TV or we can't pay our utility bill, but we've got to go to Starbucks. Where are we focused on sand rather than the golf balls, the things that are really crucially important? So we have to put those there first. We have to focus on the things that actually make a difference in our life and lead us to be happy. For us, in our faith, for me, my faith is a golf ball. My family is a golf ball. My good friends are a golf ball. And some of the things that I think, if this doesn't happen, my life is going to be over, is really just sand. If we don't get that idea that there's something about life that is more important than wealth and stuff and power and position and other people admiring you, you will miss out on what life can really be. And you can have those fruits of the Spirit: joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, faithfulness, self-control. A community of people that love each other, that can mess up and yet you can feel still loved by someone that you messed up with. In relationships that we overlook the problems that we have because we are united in a desire for each to be fully alive in Christ. There's an opportunity to experience that. This next year we're going to focus on this by doing several of you went through the Practicing the Way groups, and we're going to be bringing some of the spiritual practices around to be in groups as well. I think I've got a slide for that. Those 9 ancient practices that maybe are pebbles and not golf balls, but in your faith they are golf balls. Spending time having a Sabbath so you don't feel like you're only as good as whatever you accomplish. spending time in prayer, fasting, being comfortable and able to experience solitude and hear from God and be able to just be and be whole, be full, to be generous, which I think is one of the most consistent marks of following Jesus' generosity. Taking in Scripture, because it is the keys of life to help us to understand what God is trying to do. Community, not the kind that we just know people, but the kind that we are intimately connected, interconnected with each other. Service, witness. Matthew 7:13 says, "Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide, and the way is easy that leads to destruction. And those who enter by it are many, for the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life. And those who find it are few." You have to be intentional about living this life. We can't accidentally become followers of Jesus. We have to work towards it. We've been so overcome by a history in the church of this works-based theology that we think now all we need to do is sit around and be loved. And yet, Jesus never said to his disciples, "Come, follow me, sit around and be loved." We have the opportunity where less is more, because more gives us the opportunity for really what is more. More life, more love, more real relationships, more peace, more hope, more joy. Is that what we want? That's the story God's trying to show us. He's trying to tell us through Scripture. Will we embrace that story, or will we embrace a false story like King Herod and be miserable and paranoid and eventually die wanting to assassinate a whole bunch of people so that he could think people were mourning for him when really they're mourning for them? Sometimes less is more. And I think that's part of what the birth of Jesus is trying to show us. Would you pray with me?